You're listening to BreadboxMedia.com. The program is Setting the Record Straight, and I'm your host, Chuck Coughlin.
You could say I was a mythbuster, uncovering the truth behind the negative disinformation that is so widespread about our beloved Catholic Church, and more especially, uncovering all the forgotten history of the great achievements of the Catholic Church over the last 2,000 years. Western civilization especially owes far more to the Catholic Church than most people realize. Some established historians have said, in fact, that the Catholic Church built Western civilization. The Roman Catholic Church is certainly responsible for introducing most of the best components of Western civilization. That's what Setting the Record Straight is about. Well, today we're going to take up a rather thorny issue, which is the crusade of Islam against the Catholic Church. It's a threat that we've felt the pressure of, and the horror of, actually, for 1,300 years, 13 centuries. Well, I'm not telling you anything that it's very much a threat today. An article appeared on October 1st entitled this, Analysis, Boko Haram, ISIS Preparing to Launch Attacks Against the Vatican. Against the Vatican? Yes. This is what the article says. The African nation of Nigeria has warned the United States and European Union nations that the Islamic group Boko Haram deployed hundreds of jihadists to Libyan cities, including Benghazi, to offer aid to the Nigerian group's ally, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. We call this ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, ISIS, ISIS. The influx of Nigerian jihadists is expected to escalate in an effort to take control of the Arab country that's been in a shambles since the overthrow and execution of Libya's dictator, Colonel Muammar Gaddafi. Even more frightening to many are the reports that Boko Haram and ISIS are threatening that once they're in control of Libya and that nation's resources, including weapons, they will likely launch attacks on the Vatican in Italy. Boko Haram, which means Western education is a sin, has dispatched at least 200 Nigerian jihadists who possess advanced weaponry to bolster the already increasing numbers of ISIS forces in Africa. The current intelligence appears to prove the statements of those who are claiming there's a growing alliance between the two merciless groups are accurate statements. Now, originally, Boko Haram has sworn allegiance to what is now known as Khor al-Qaeda, especially its Yemen-based offshoot known as al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. But with the ISIS victories in Iraq, Syria, and other locations, it wasn't surprising to intelligence agents when Boko Haram decided it was time to join up with ISIS, according to Jeff Pierce, a former police department counterterrorism unit commander. The fighters of ISIS, who continue their battles in the Middle East, are now fighting to take control of Libya, which has been in the midst of a bloody civil war. Because as jihadists begin, it is an excellent condition from which to initiate an invasion of a European city. With the new jihadists pouring into Libya to help ISIS fighters, according to former police counterterrorism unit commander Vincent Pollard, ISIS leaders are bragging on social media websites that they will use their victory in Libya in order to launch an invasion of Italy, perhaps attacking the home of the Roman Catholic Pope in the Vatican. Pollard is quoted in this article saying this, "There have been threats made against Europe before, but now ISIS leaders and their associates have taken to identify their prized target, the Holy City in Rome." ISIS has also created a series of illustrations and messages for the Internet, including one that shows the black flag of ISIS above the Vatican and the Catholic symbols replaced with Muslim designs and artwork, Pollard noted. A man claiming to be a soldier of Allah, Abu el-Gandar Barkawi, told ISIS reporters that a message to go to Rome through Libya. The weapons of the Ottomans were launched and have surrounded Rome after conquering Libya to the south of Italy. Who wants to take Rome and Andalusia has to start from Libya. According to a number of news stories, ISIS has sought the strengthening of its ties with Boko Haram in recent months amid signs that its overstretched forces are beginning to be beaten back across the Middle East. In June, ISIS declared territory seized by Boko Haram in Nigeria
and its West African province. Nigerian counterterrorism expert Jacob Zinn told the news media in Africa that between 60 to 200 of the Boko Haram Islamists are currently fighting alongside ISIS jihadists in the Libyan city of Sirte, which ISIS claims as its capital in North Africa. The Nigerian government's press official adds, there have been reports in recent times of some Nigerians departing to join terrorist groups, especially in the Middle East and North Africa.
Well, what can we make of all this? It's certainly ominous sounding, isn't it?
When you look back through history, you come across a major Catholic leader who advocated our might to both stem the tide of an invading and quite bloody army, as well as to protect individual Catholics threatened by the same invaders. Almost 1,000 years later, the warning, largely attributed to philosopher Jorge Santayana, still rings true. Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. In arguably the truest form of religious ecumenism, in 1095, Byzantine Emperor Alexius I Komnenos. He appealed to Pope Urban in the hope that Pope Urban was the one figure who could unite the Western Catholic countries to come to the aid of the Eastern Catholic countries against the invasions and attacks of the Turks and Arabs. I think you and I know it's really the attack of Islam against Catholicism. Their declared enemy was Islam, who had taken nearly all the Byzantine lands in Asia Minor, the Near and the Middle East. So it was then that the Pope Blessed Urban II changed the course of world history by calling on all of the West sovereigns to not only aid their Greek brethren, but also to liberate the Holy Lands captured by invading Muslim armies. You know, one French reporter wrote this, "It certainly appears that everything old is new again." In a curious change of leads, now it appears the Eastern Church is rescuing the Western Church. The very Reverend Archpriest Vlesevold Shaplin didn't exactly mince words when it came to where the Russian Orthodox Church stands on troops from Mother Russia engaged in combat in Syria. With Syria's sizable Christian minority being a favorite target of murder, torture, and kidnapping by Islamic jihadists such as Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and the Al-Nusra Front, Father Chaplin declared the fight with terrorism is a holy battle. And he went on to say this, that today his own country, Russia, is the most active force in the world fighting it. Verifying that Father Chaplin had gone rogue, the Patriarch of Moscow and all Russia and the Primate of the Russian Orthodox Church, Patriarch Cyril, said Russia took a responsible decision to use military forces to protect the Syrian people from the horrendous persecutions against Catholics and other Christians committed by the Islamic jihadists. Would you think that a follower of Christ would advocate military action? This one does. Patriarch Cyril does advocate military action. He stated he thought that military action was needed, since, as he said, quote, the political process has not led to any noticeable improvement in the lives of innocent people, and they need military protection. Patriarch Cyril's call is eerily reminiscent of Blessed Urban's shaming. And keep in mind, this was 1,000 years ago. Of Pope Urban's shaming of the weak-kneed Western lords and princes and kings who were inspired by his great speech and quit squabbling with each other and joined together in the first great military pilgrimage, later pejoratively called the Crusade. You know, there's various versions of the speech written down by different chroniclers, and they're probably all paraphrases, but they do reveal the actual thinking of Pope Urban about the pilgrimage. One chronicler, his name is Fulcher, put these words in Pope Urban's mouth. I, or rather the Lord, beseech you as Christ heralds to publish this everywhere and to purse all people of whatever rank, foot soldiers and knights, poor and rich, to carry aid promptly to those Catholics and to destroy that vile race from the lands of our friends. I say this to those who are present. It is meant also for those who are absent. Moreover, Christ commands it. Another chronicler, Robert the Monk, put down these words. Pope Urban saying, this land which you inhabit, shut in all sides by the seas and surrounded by mountain peaks, is too narrow for your large population, nor does it abound in wealth, and it furnishes scarcely food enough for its cultivators. Hence it is that you murder one another, that you wage war, and that frequently you perish by mutual wounds. Let therefore hatred depart from among you. Let your quarrels end. Let wars cease, and let all dissensions and controversies slumber. Enter upon the road to the Holy Sepulchre. Wrest that land from the wicked race, as subjected to yourselves. God has conferred upon you above all nations great glory and arms. Accordingly, undertake this journey for the remission of your sins, with the assurance of the imperishable glory of the kingdom of heaven. So Robert the monk describes that after Pope Urban said that everyone present cried out, "It is the will of God." When the venerable Roman pontiff heard that, he said, "Most beloved brethren, today is manifest in you what the Lord says in the gospel. Where two or three are gathered together in my name, there am I in the midst of them. Unless the Lord had been present in your spirits, all of you would not have uttered the same cry. For although the cry issued from numerous mouths, yet the origin of the cry was one. Therefore I say to you that God, who implanted this in your breasts, has drawn it forth from you. Let this then be your war cry in combats, because this word is given to you by God. When an armed attack is made upon the enemy, let this one cry be raised by all the soldiers of God. It is the will of God. It is the will of God."
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
You're listening to breadboxmedia.com. The program is Setting the Record Straight, and I'm your host, Chuck Coughlin.
Just before the break, we were listening to some of Pope Urban's words at Clermont when he spoke to the crowned heads of Western Europe's Catholic countries, the leaders of Catholicdom, and called the first great pilgrimage, the first great crusade, to free the Holy Land from Islamic domination. Another historian, Fulcher of Chartres, gave an account of Pope Urban's speech in which there was a promise of the remission of sins for whoever took part in the Crusades, a plainer indulgence. These are the words that Fulcher put down. "All who die by the way, either by land or by sea, or in battle against the pagans, shall have immediate remission of sins. This I grant them through the power of God, with which I am invested." So, my dear listeners, at this point, Pope Urban urges them to quit squabbling among themselves and unite against their common enemy. This is a point in history in which the concept of chivalry became truly noble. There's no one moment that created the knight, but this is a moment that contributed mightily to the creation of that noble, virtuous state. Let us listen to Pope Urban. "Let those who have been accustomed unjustly to wage private warfare against our own faithful now go against the infidels, and end with the victory this war should have begun long ago. Let those who for a long time have been robbers now become knights. Let those who have been fighting against their brothers and relatives now fight in a proper way against the barbarians. Let those who have been serving as mercenaries for small pay now obtain the eternal reward. Those who have been wearing themselves out in both body and soul now work for a double honor. Behold, on this side will be the sorrowful and poor, on that the rich. On this side the enemies of the Lord, on that his friends. Let those who go not put off the journey, but rent their lands and collect money for their expenses. And as soon as winter is over and spring comes, let them eagerly set out on the way with God as their guide." No, you have to think of what a great contrast with this brave speech, this bold speech, when compared with those of our own leaders, and what we say to one another. We seem not sure of ourselves. We seem not sure of our own Catholicism, the church founded by Christ, to which he very plainly gave the power to forgive sins and to assign punishments, to create, to magnify or reduce punishment, and certainly gave the power to the bishops and the Pope to create indulgences. We started to doubt this when we became too tolerant, exercising the kind of tolerance that Chesterton spoke of when he said, tolerance is a vice disguised as a virtue. An illustration of this is during the controversy a few years back about whether to build a mosque at Ground Zero, at the former site of the World Trade Center, before it was destroyed and 3,000 lives were destroyed by Islamic terrorists, Mohammed Atta and his assistants. So one of the unconscious memes, I say unconscious, uncritical, lazy thoughts that spread from person to person at that time, it went viral during this controversy over the Ground Zero Mosque, was that Christians have no standing in virtue to criticize the violence of Islam, given a supposedly violent Christian history. Most people accept this, and it's quite false. No one event is more often invoked as an example of Christian hypocrisy than the Crusades. Crusades? No one who fought in them called them that. It was centuries later. It's part of the black legend to defame the Catholic Church, to slander the Catholic Church. The latest and most appalling example of this black legend appeared in the New York Times, written by Nicholas Kristof, the famous columnist. Among the many absurdities one found in this column, including definitive claims as to the intentions and desires of Osama bin Laden, Kristof also wrote these words. Listen to Kristof. Remember that also, historically, some of the most shocking brutality in the region was justified by the Bible, not the Koran. Crusaders massacred so many men, women, and children in parts of Jerusalem that a Christian chronicler, Fulcher of Chartres, described an area ankle-deep in blood. While burning Jews alive, the Crusaders sang, Christ, we adore thee. So that's what Kristof wrote. What could be more logical, more pertinent, more relevant than to invoke thousand-year-old wartime excesses as proof that Christians have no grounds to criticize Islam? One can go the route of modern liberal Christianity and make statements about how either A, the Crusades were a, quote, mistake and never should have occurred, or perhaps B, that while they may have been justified at the time, Christianity has undergone sufficient reforms to prevent such things from happening again, while Islam is not. The word reform, of course, evoking the Protestant Reformation, and a better term for that would have been the Protestant deformation. It led to Nazism and Marxism, and I've covered that in other programs. So A and B, were the Crusades a mistake? No. We can reject that totally. The second, that the Crusades were an example of unjustifiable religious violence on the part of Christians. Moreover, one that can be constantly invoked to equivocate Christianity and Islam as religions that are both prone to violence. Now, if ever there was a record that needed to be set straight, this is it. First, the historical facts. Quote, a long train of abuses, to borrow Jefferson's phrase, preceded the launching of the First Crusade in 1096. Since its very inception, Islam had waged an unremitting war against Christianity. It conquered and subjugated centuries-old Christian societies in the Middle East and in northern Africa. After sweeping through France, the Muslim advance was finally checked by Charles Martel at the Battle of Tours in 732. The Battle of Tours, if you don't know it, is one of the most consequential battles in all of history. That's where Charles Martel stopped the Muslim advance. So following that Battle of Tours, Muslim aggression against Christians did continue in southern Italy with the conquest of Sicily almost 100 years later, 827. Resistance to these repeated acts resistance to these repeated acts of aggression was not characterized as a, quote, crusade, but simply self-defense, a necessary self-defense. Over the next centuries, the Turks who had converted to Islam waged war against the Eastern Christian Byzantine Empire. At the Battle of Manzikert in 1071, the Turks wiped out the Byzantine army, leaving the emperor, Alexius Comnenus, helpless before a relentless and determined foe. Not long after this, he sent envoys to Pope Urban II, pleading for military aid. The Council of Clermont was called by the Pope, the years 1095. Pope Urban addressed the clergy, the knights, and commoners who had assembled. We've just been listening to excerpts from his speech. Let's listen to a little more of it. Listen to Pope Urban II in his speech at Clermont. It was not at all the typical evocation of the war spirit. What it was forcing the nobles to look at themselves, to look into their own hearts and souls, and confess to themselves that they'd been behaving poorly, and that an opportunity had presented itself to recover their chivalric knighthood, their virtue. Listen to Pope Urban. You, the oppressors of children, plunderers of widows, you guilty of homicide or of sacrilege, robbers of another's rights, you who await the pay of thieves for the shedding of Christian blood, as vultures smell fetid corpses, so do you sense battles from afar and rush to them eagerly? Truly, this is the worst way, for it is utterly removed from God. If you wish to be mindful of your souls, either lay down the girdle of such knighthood, or advance boldly, as knights of Christ, and rush as quickly as you can to the defense of our Eastern Church, for she it is from whom the joys of your whole salvation have come forth, who poured into your mouths the milk of divine wisdom, who set before you the holy teachings of the Gospels. So spoke Pope Urban. These words might seem overheated, but they absolutely were not. They were words that fit the occasion, because what was at stake was nothing less than the preservation of Catholicism and the civilization which had, even if imperfectly, sought to embody its teachings in the world. This was also evidenced by the increasing hostility to Catholics still living in the Levant. The Levant is the Holy Land, as well as those who went on pilgrimage. There were many outrages committed against Catholics and Christians. There was one that preceded the First Crusade. The year was 1009. The famed Caliph Al-Hakim, often called the Mad Caliph Hakim, ordered the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, in a fit of madness, razed to the ground. This was followed by an even broader campaign against Christianity throughout the Levant, culminating in the mass destruction of Catholic churches. Given the scale of unprovoked and ceaseless attacks, as well as the persecution of Christians within the Holy Land itself, I believe the Crusades were more than justified when we understand that they were in fact a belated response to centuries of violent Islamic expansion and not a random and spontaneous act of aggression. Spontaneous acts of random aggression, just like every Muslim assault on Catholic countries was. I don't see how a reasonable person can deny this. We've got to break now. On BreadboxMedia.com, this is Chuck Coughlin.
Considering, with a very heavy heart, more than 13 centuries of Islamic aggression upon our beloved Catholic faith, on BreadboxMedia.com, we're setting the record straight, bringing history out of the shadows, myth-busting.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
You're listening to breadboxmedia.com. The program is Setting the Record Straight, and I'm your host, Chuck Coughlin.
Before the break, we were talking about the criticisms of Nicholas Kristof, New York Times columnist, of the Catholic Church in the First Crusade. Unwarranted criticism, miseducated criticism. We need to set the record straight. To return to the theme, given the scale of unprovoked and ceaseless attacks, as well as the persecution of Christians within the Holy Land itself, I believe the Crusades were more than justified when we understand that they were in fact a belated response to centuries of violent Islamic expansion, and not a random and spontaneous act of aggression. Spontaneous acts of random aggression, just like every Muslim assault on Catholic countries was. I don't see how a reasonable person can deny this. And what about the atrocities that Nicholas Kristof brought up? Here again, we can point to some substantive difference between Islam and Christianity. Violence against and persecution of Jews was never encouraged, tolerated, or condoned by the papacy. Christianity did not need 1,000 years to clean up its act with regard to the Jews. In response to the atrocities carried out by the soldiers in the crusading armies, Pope Calixtus II issued the bull Sicut Judaeus in 1120, which declared, among other things, that, quote, the Jews ought to suffer no prejudice. We, out of the meekness of Christian piety, and in keeping in the footprints of our predecessors of happy memory, the Roman pontiffs Calixtus, Eugene, Alexander, Clement, admit their petition, and we grant them the buckler of our protection. Let me translate that for you. In other words, when Catholics carried out acts of violence against Jews, they were doing so in disobedience to their religion. In disobedience, violating their religion and their spiritual leaders. This was also the case during the unfortunate sack of Constantinople in 1203. Catholics turned upon Catholics in the Fourth Crusade. However, in the Islamic Hadith, which are narrations considered the supplements to the Quran, we can read this, quote, the final hour will not start until after the Muslims fight the Jews and the Muslims kill them. The Jew will hide behind a stone or a tree, and the tree will say, O Muslim, O servant of Allah, this is a Jew behind me. Come and kill him. Unquote. Could the contrast be more clear? Even the supposedly backward thoughts of medieval popes are progressive and enlightened compared to what a significant number of Muslims believe today. As for the bloodletting of Jerusalem, while such individual incidents are certainly regrettable, it was rather common at the time for savagery to follow a long and protracted siege of a city. This does not excuse it, of course, and especially if the men carrying it out are purporting to act in the name of Christ. But we shouldn't react as if it were some great deviation from the standards of the time, which in themselves greatly deviate from our own. What about the very idea of the Crusades, in light of modern sensibilities? Well, you've got to consider the great sacrifices made by the kings, knights, clergy of Catholicdom to undergo this pilgrimage, what they have to give up to go on the pilgrimage. They went thousands of miles away, on foot usually, in the service of Christ and His church. I could never bring myself to condemn it or shy away from it. Great risks were undertaken and losses suffered, for no assurances of material compensation or reward were likely. Indeed, the common thing was to be impoverished by going on a crusade. To leave all behind and take up the cross is the noblest thing a human being can do, whether they bear arms in defense of their Christian brothers, or they live a life of poverty, chastity, and obedience, or, as in case of the Knights Templar, they do all of the above. Even if, in today's circumstances, many of us have replaced the full, robust faith of Catholicism with a shallow sort of secular humanism, behind every Westerner's desire to free Tibet or to end genocide in Darfur is the same basic spirit that motivated the original Crusaders. It's a desire to bring justice and comfort to those suffering under the yoke of tyrants, and to resist a foe that has made it clear their intent to conquer through centuries and centuries of persistent aggression. Well, since Nicholas Kristof wants us to, quote, remember things, let us remember a few more. First, let us remember that the goals of the Crusades did not include the conversion of Muslims to Christianity, and that the few conversion attempts made were largely unsuccessful. Not only that, but Arab travelers living at the time noted that Muslims lived better under their Frankish rulers, their Catholic rulers, than they did under the rule of other Muslims. It's also worth remembering that the Crusades failed, that the Islamo-Turks did overrun southeastern Europe and would have taken over all the rest of it as well, had they not been checked twice at Vienna. That was 1529-1683. It may also be worth remembering that it was not until the so-called Age of Enlightenment that Europeans actually did conquer and actually did colonize the Middle East and also North Africa. That was the product of the Enlightenment, the product of secularization. Apparently, all of the wisdom that suddenly flowed in upon the rejection of medieval religion and the embrace of skepticism, humanism, and all the rest that goes with the so-called Enlightenment, did not preclude unprovoked wars and imperialist conquest out of Europe against the rest of the world, and specifically the Middle East. It looks like that was a product of the Enlightenment. I guess it was. Of course, I'm sure that the counter to that position would be, quote, we just hadn't gotten far enough away from religion yet. Well, it's finally worth remembering that even in the first decade of the 19th century, Thomas Jefferson launched a little crusade of his own against Islam, against the Barbary pirates in North Africa, in Libya, Tunisia, Morocco. They were Islamic, and they justified their criminality and aggression through the Quran. And they'd been capturing and pillaging the vessels of infidels for centuries, enslaving them. Their European nations bribed them to stop doing it. Jefferson refused and invented the Marines to go defeat them in Libya to the shores of Tripoli. So maybe it's not so far-fetched to use the word crusade to describe the first Barbary War or Jefferson's intent. He didn't have to fight them, and many American statesmen would have rather paid the tribute, paid the bribe they instantly demanded. But Jefferson was determined to end the extortion, and he did end the extortion. It was 1805. An American force, along with local mercenaries, captured the city of Tripoli and brought the rage to an end. Well, at least until a second Barbary War. There's one takeaway here, is that Catholics and Christians of all types have to be forearmed with the historical knowledge and moral fortitude required to defend their own traditions and their own legacy in the world. They have to have the straight record. We can use the truth. We have the advantage that the truth is on our side in this. What we genuinely have to regret, let us regret, but let us also resist and expose the historical falsifiers and the fallacies they employ to disarm us and defeat us. Like a kid said once, you have to compare. Just like older American adults of today who grew up under the threat of communism, so European adults in the year 1492 grew up under the threat of Islam, an ever-aggressive, encroaching Islam. Now, particularly during the 1950s, Americans were concerned with the forces of communism threatening to engulf the world. Marx and Engels had promised exactly that. The communists had seized power in the Soviet Union in 1917, in China in 1948, together with Eastern Europe, Southeast Asia, and Cuba, and they controlled nearly one-third of the world's landmass and nearly one-half of the world's population. So Americans took seriously Nikita Khrushchev's boast, "We will bury you," and despite the remarkable events of 1989 and 91, I am not yet convinced that communism has collapsed and the threat is over. The direction that China will take is still up in the air. And they have their adherents like North Korea and Cuba. But my point is that remembering how Americans felt about communism in the 50s helps us understand how Europeans feared Islam in 1492. Humanly speaking, Islam threatened medieval and Renaissance Europe just as much as communism threatens or threatened the free world of the 20th century. Like communism, Islam was an ideology that transcended national boundaries. Like communism, Islam engaged in rapid expansion. Like communism, Muslims openly declared their goal of conquering the world for their cause. And like communism, Islam posed a spiritual threat to Christianity. Instead of atheism versus Christ, the challenge of Allah versus the triune God of the Bible was the case. And just as American foreign policy throughout the second half of the 20th century centered upon opposition to and containment of communism, too much so in the eyes of some, not enough in the eyes of others, including me, so foreign policy in medieval and Renaissance European nations focused upon opposition to and containment of Islam. Unless one understands the threat Islam posed to European Christians during the medieval period and beyond, it is impossible to understand the mindsets and motivations of the explorers. To Christopher Columbus, the voyage westward is a way of reaching the Orient, and after Catholicizing the Orient, joining forces with Asia to turn back the threat of Islam. To Cortez, the Aztecs were a heathen nation, to be converted or conquered, just like that of the Muslim Moors and Turks.
Why don't you stick with me after the break? And we'll briefly trace the events in the world leading up to 1492, and help us understand better this age-old conflict between Islam and Catholicism, and understand the mind and motives of the early explorers. That would help a lot, too. On Breadbox Media, this is Chuck Coughlin.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
You're listening to breadboxmedia.com. The program is Setting the Record Straight, and I'm your host, Chuck Coughlin.
We're back with you. This is Chuck Coughlin on BreadboxMedia.com about the conflict between Islam and Catholicism. There's more to it than I can do in a little bitty show like this, but we're doing what we can. Hope you appreciate that. So we're talking about the history of Islam. Now, Muhammad wasn't born till the 600s. So 600 years before that, in the time of Christ, he created the Catholic Church. And for the first 3 centuries after the birth of Christ, Catholics were the subject of frequent persecution. It was intermittent, but it was severe. It was persecution by the Roman government. Then around 312 AD, Emperor Constantine became a Catholic and made Catholicism the official religion of the Roman Empire. One reason was that Catholicism became identified with the possession of certain territory, and lands under Catholic rule came to be called Christendom. Properly understood, this did not mean that one was a Christian simply because one lived in a Christian land. Rather, it meant, or should have meant, that people in such lands were free to worship Christ and practice Catholicism, which was the version of Christianity, and that civilization and culture of such lands reflected biblical values. For political reasons, Constantine also divided the empire in AD 330. Now, the eastern half of the Roman Empire was to be ruled from what was called Byzantium, and that city was renamed Constantinople, and the original western half was to be ruled from Rome. The Roman Empire of the West declined, embattled by barbarians from outside its borders, and weakened by moral and military decay within. Most historians date the end of the Western Empire at around 476 AD, when Germanic tribes took control of the city of Rome. Now, in the East, though, the Roman Empire continued for another 1,000 years, until 1453, when Constantinople fell. It was under Christian rulers, and a church that gradually became what is now known as the Eastern Orthodox Church. So a long time later, around 610 AD, an Arab businessman named Muhammad claimed to have had special revelations from the one true God. He called him Allah and began preaching a new faith. Those teachings are found in the Quran, the holy book of Islam, and they're easily summarized as the 5 dogmas of Islam. The first is this: one. There is one and only one God, Allah. For this reason, Muslims have objected to the Christian view of the Trinity. 2. Muhammad was Allah's greatest messenger. Muslims believed Allah also spoke through Abraham, Moses, and Jesus, and possibly to some extent through other Old Testament prophets. But Muhammad was the greatest of these. However, Muhammad was only a man, and he died like other men. For this reason, I am told followers of his faith prefer to call themselves Muslims or Muslims rather than Mohammedans, and prefer to call their religion Islam rather than Mohammedanism. Because they do not worship Muhammad, the way Christians worship Christ. The third pillar is, the Quran is the word of God, dictated to Muhammad by the angel Gabriel. Now, Muslims also accept the Old Testament and the Gospels as divine revelation, to the extent that they are consistent with the Quran. Where they contradict the Quran, Muslims believe they've been corrupted from the original manuscripts. During the early centuries of Islam, a dispute arose among Muslims as to whether the Quran was co-eternal with Allah, and therefore infallibly true and universally applicable, or whether the Quran was created by Allah and time, and therefore is infallibly true, but subject to different interpretations over time. Eventually, the first position won out. The fourth is, Gabriel heads a hierarchy of angels who serve Allah and intervene for man. Well, Muslims also believe in jinns, evil spirit created out of fire. Jinns are sort of like demons. Muslims don't regard them as fallen angels. The fifth and last dogma of Islam is after death, man faces Allah's judgment, reward in paradise or punishment in hell. This judgment is based upon works, although Muslims also emphasize that Allah is compassionate and merciful. His mercy is generally contingent upon a man's repentance. But this judgment, Pache Martin Luther, is based upon works. The Quran describes paradise as a place of luxury and sensuality. I'll quote, reclining upon couches lined with silk brocade, the fruit of both gardens near to hand, therein are those of modest gaze, whom neither man nor jinni will have touched before them in beauty, like the hyacinths and the coral stone. And beside them are two other gardens, dark green with foliage, wherein are two abundant springs, wherein is fruit, the date palm and pomegranate, where are found the good and beautiful, fair ones, close guarded in pavilions, whom neither man nor jinni will have touched before them, reclining on green cushions and fair carpets. That's from chapter 55. Now, how does one achieve these rewards in paradise? The Muslim answer is the obligatory duties known as the five pillars of Islam. One is verbal profession that there is one God, Allah, and Muhammad is prophet. The second is prayer, which is to take place at five set times each day, according to prescribed positions and rituals. The third is almsgiving to the poor. And four is fasting, complete abstinence from food and drink during the hours of daylight, during the month of Ramadan, the ninth month of the Islamic year. Plus additional fasting is penitence for certain sins. Five, pilgrimage to a holy shrine, Mecca being the central and most favored site. Now, Muslims frequently speak of jihad or holy war, fighting in the way of Allah, as a sixth pillar. I'm going to emphasize jihad, not because of its importance in life of the average Muslim believer, but because it has played a major role in the relations of Islamic powers with other nations, and because many Muslims do not like to admit that it's part of their religion. But jihad occupies a central place. Where? In the Quran. A central place in the Quran. Listen to the words of the Quran. Chapter 2, verse 190. Fight in the way of Allah against those who fight against you, but begin not hostilities. Allah loveth not aggression. Verse 191. And slay them wherever you find them, and drive them out of the holy places whence they drove you out, for persecution is worse than slaughter. And fight not with them at the inviolable place of worship, until they first attack you there, then slay them. Such is the reward of disbelievers. 192. But if they desist, then lo, Allah is forgiving, merciful. 193. And fight them until persecution is no more, and religion is for Allah. But if they desist, then let there be no hostility, except against wrongdoers. Verse 216. Warfare is ordained for you, though it is hateful unto you, but it may happen that ye hate a thing which is good for you, and it may happen that ye love a thing which is bad for you. Allah knoweth, ye know not. 217. And they will not cease from fighting against you till they have made you renegades from your religion, if they can. 246. Bethink thee of the leadership of the children of Israel after Moses. How they said unto a prophet whom they had, Set up for us a king, and we will fight in Allah's way. He said, Would ye then refrain from fighting if fighting was prescribed for you? They said, Why should we not fight in Allah's way when we have been driven from our dwellings with our children? Yet when fighting was prescribed for them, they turned away, all save a few of them. Allah is aware of evildoers. Chapter 9, verse 5. Then when the sacred months have passed, slay the idolaters wherever you find them and take them captive and prepare for them each ambush. But if they repent and establish worship and pay the poor due, then leave their way free. Lo, Allah is forgiving, merciful. 29. Fight against such of those who have been given the scripture and believe not in Allah nor the last day, and forbid not that which Allah hath forbidden by his messenger, and follow not the religion of truth until they pay the tribute readily, being brought low. 36. And wage war on all the idolaters as they are waging war on all of you, and know that Allah is with those who keep their duty unto him. 41. Go forth light-armed and heavy-armed, and strive with your wealth and your lives in the way of Allah, that is best for you, if ye but knew. And never pray for one of them who dieth, nor stand by his grave. Lo, they disbelieved in Allah and his messenger, and they died while they were evildoers. 123. O ye who believe, fight those of the disbelievers who are near to you, and let them find harshness in you, and know that Allah is with those who keep their duty unto him. Chapter 47, verse 4. Now when you meet in battle those who disbelieve, then it is smiting of the necks, until ye have routed them, then making fast of bonds, and afterward either grace or ransom, till the war lay down its burdens. And if Allah willeth, he could have punished them without you. But thus it is ordained that he may try some of you by means of others. And those who are slain in the way of Allah, he rendereth not their actions in vain. Verse 5, he will guide them and improve their state. Verse 6, and bring them unto the garden which he has made.
So I've offered you a few short readings from the Quran itself, so that you may judge it for yourself. We'll return to this theme later in other programs. But we did what we could in an hour. Thanks for listening. This is BreadboxMedia.com. I'm Chuck Coughlin. So good to have you listening. Setting the record straight.